It's Wednesday, May 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, U.S. presidential politics gets uglier as Indiana voters cast important ballots. The United States and Russia try to work out a new plan in Syria.
Tension between the two countries has been going up ever since North Korea tested a nuclear bomb early this year.
South Korea raises abduction concerns by the North. Also ahead, Australia's refugee policy criticized again. On stage, Hamilton is already a big winner. It's all on today's International Edition. Voters in the Midwestern U.S. state of Indiana are at the polls in a crucial Republican presidential primary where frontrunner Donald Trump faces a showdown with his closest rival, Texas Senator Ted Cruz. A Trump victory in Indiana would likely put the billionaire real estate mogul on a glide path to clinching the Republican Party's presidential nomination before its July national convention in Cleveland. In a strange twist Tuesday, Mr. Trump asserted Ted Cruz's father was linked with Lee Harvey Oswald, the accused assassin of President John F. Kennedy. Ted Cruz responded about the unsubstantiated claim and about his thoughts on Trump's personal character.
Listen, Donald Trump is a serial philanderer, and he boasts about it. This is not a secret. He's proud of being a serial philanderer. I want everyone to think about your teenage kids. The President of the United States talks about how great it is to commit adultery, how proud he is. Describes his battles with venereal disease as his own personal Vietnam. Even though he boasts about his infidelity, he plants in David Pecker's National Enquirer a lie about me and my family, attacking my family. He accuses others of doing what he is doing. I'll tell you, as the father of two young girls, the idea of our daughters coming home and repeating any word that man says horrifies me. That is not who America is. And I would say to the Hoosier State, the entire country is depending on you.
Well, as voters headed to the polls, a video went viral in Indiana as employees of the Carrier Air Conditioner Company were told their manufacturing plant would be closed and relocated to Mexico.
The best way to stay competitive and protect the business for long term is to move production from our facility in Indianapolis to Monterrey, Mexico.
This type of job flight to less expensive locations outside of the United States has been a central theme of Mr. Trump's campaign, and he wasted no time pouncing on the development.
I'm going to tell them right now, I am going to get consensus from Congress, and we're going to tax you when those air conditions come. So stay where you are or build in the United States.
Ted Cruz is a conservative firebrand in the halls of Congress here in Washington, and he's campaigned for a week in Indiana, urging voters to support him in an effort to stop Trump from claiming a first ballot nomination victory at the upcoming national convention. Trump has won the last six state nominating contests over Cruz and another Republican contender, Ohio Governor John Kasich. Trump cannot clinch the nomination with an Indiana win, but numerous U.S. political analysts say that a victory would hand him a psychological edge among voters in the remaining nine state party nominating contests that run through early June. All but one pre-election survey in Indiana shows that Trump is leading Cruz, some by large margins. Trump, a one-time television reality show host who has never held elective office, seemed confident enough of an Indiana victory that focused his attacks on his closing rally like Democratic presidential nominee former U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. They would face each other in November's national election if both eventually secure their party's presidential nominations, and Clinton is already making the assumption that she'll be facing Trump.
Mr. Trump accused me of playing the, quote, woman card. Well, if fighting for women's health care and paid family leave and equal pay is playing the woman card, then deal me in.
Mrs. Clinton's rival is Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. He continues his bid for the Democratic nomination, even though his chances are growing increasingly slim.
We believe that we are in a very strong position to win many of these remaining contests, and we have an excellent chance to win in California, the state with far and away the most delegates.
Mrs. Clinton enjoys an overwhelming lead in delegates and is rapidly closing in on her needed count for her party's nomination. Well, we take a look at social media, and to do that, International Edition's G. Abby Lee joins me here in the studio. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim.
So, tell us the social media reaction to Donald Trump's description of his rival, Ted Cruz's father.
It's definitely one of the trending topics on social media today. As we heard earlier in an interview with Fox News, Trump claimed Cruz's father had ties to the man who killed former President John F. Kennedy. His name, as you mentioned earlier, is Lee Harvey Oswald, and his name is also trending on Twitter at this hour.
Well, what's the media's coverage like?
The two main media outlets that highlighted the claim are, of course, Fox News and the New York Times. Fox News posted Cruz's response on Facebook, writing, "Ted Cruz dismissed the claim this morning and mocked Donald Trump for bringing up tabloid trash." The New York Times was less favorable to Trump than Fox News, posting this: "Donald Trump, who has repeatedly dabbled in conspiracy theories, has accused Trump, Cruz's dad, of associating with Lee Harvey Oswald."
So how is the public reacting to these posts?
Well, I found a lot of comments by who I believe are Trump supporters to the Fox News post. They claimed if Cruz doesn't want anyone saying anything about his father, he should not stay in the presidential race. Others expressed their concern for the Republican Party. One person wrote, "I didn't know Trump could sink any lower. If he gets a nomination, he's going to lose all the people who supported Cruz. Hello, Madame President Hillary." That's, of course, referring to the Democratic contender Hillary Clinton.
Well, beyond politics, I'm sure there's something else trending.
That's right. And it's Star Wars Day. Tomorrow, May 4th, is the day of the space fantasy film series. The reason why it's on May 4th is because the date sounds similar to a phrase used in the film series. Can you guess what it is?
What?
May the 4th be with you. I guess you're not a Star Wars fan. People around the world celebrated by dressing as Star Wars characters and hosting movie screenings. Jim?
Well, that's pretty awesome. Thank you so much, G. And actually, I saw the very first one when it first came out.
Oh, nice.
If you end up dressing up to celebrate the Star Wars Day, please tweet us some pictures and comments to @VOA_IE. You can also tag me and G on those tweets if you like. We are @VOA Stevenson and @GAbbyLee. This is VOA. Now time to check out some of the top stories trending in Asia. Huge fire adds to woes for Myanmar's Rohingya Muslims. Pakistan says no military action against Afghan Taliban on its soil. Tensions rising ahead of South China Sea ruling. Chinese netizens mock Donald Trump over rape remarks. Former U.S. detainee says North Korea tried to use him as a negotiating tool. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more at the voanews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. A team led by the United States, Russia, and the United Nations is working to finalize a plan that could lead to the restoration of a cessation of hostilities in Syria, where fighting between the government and rebels could unhinge a multinational effort to fight the Islamic State. Secretary of State John Kerry commented on Tuesday, a day after holding emergency talks in Geneva.
"The cessation of hostilities was put in place precisely to give the people on the ground who are innocently caught between these warring factions some breather, some ability to be able to be safe, and work this out at the negotiating table, which is waiting for the parties to come back to it in order to resolve this issue."
Kerry also spoke by phone to Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. The United States and Russia are co-chairs of a ceasefire task force in Syria. Earlier Tuesday, Lavrov told reporters that he was hopeful that a truce could be agreed to in the nearest future, even in the coming hours. The flurry of meetings comes after a ceasefire announced by world powers in February began unraveling, especially in Aleppo, Syria's largest city. VOA correspondent Louise Ramirez says Russia has been a difficult partner so far in the efforts to maintain a lasting ceasefire.
The United States has called on Russia to help stop the carnage in Aleppo because, well, it has influence over the Assad government and believes that Moscow can, in fact, step in to stop that. The problem here is whether Moscow will do it or not. Thus far, they have defended those airstrikes.
Since late April, more than 270 people have died as a result of fighting in the city, including more than 50 who were killed in a Thursday airstrike on a hospital blamed on the regime. Just days before the opening of a rare North Korean Workers' Party Congress on Friday, South Korea directed its foreign embassies to guard against possible North Korean attempts to kidnap South Koreans overseas. Pyongyang has threatened retaliation following last month's group defection of 13 North Koreans in China that it claims were abducted by South Korean spies. Nearly 30,000 North Koreans are estimated to have fled their country since the armistice that ended hostilities during the 1950 to 1953 Korean War, although the rate of defections has declined in recent years. Tens of thousands of South Koreans were abducted by the North during the war, and several hundred are still believed to be there. Go Myung-hyun, a research fellow at the Seoul-based Asan Institute for Policy Studies, tells VOA's Victor Beatty that many South Korean fishermen have been kidnapped, but the North has used other methods.
Oftentimes, a North Korean agent masquerades as an innocent, even a South Korean or somebody else, and then oftentimes they lure the victims to North Korea or actually countries in Eastern Europe with offers of seminars or jobs. So that's how usually the North Korean agents would lure the victims to the friendly territories in Europe, elsewhere or in North Korea proper.
What do they do with the South Koreans once they're in North Korea?
They are used for propaganda purposes. Oftentimes what happens is the South Koreans, first when they arrive, they have a major press conference announcing their defection to North Korea, announce that they defected to North Korea because they've been disillusioned or they've been persecuted in South Korea. And they came to North Korea because the political system or society in North Korea is much, much superior to their South Korean counterpart. And after that, they are often used as instructors in their intelligence schools in North Korea, training the next cohort of North Korean agents to, in turn, will be sent out to kidnap even more South Koreans.
Are they also used as bargaining chips to return defectors from the North to the South?
That's a pretty new phenomenon. That started happening after the end of Cold War. What happened was that after the Cold War and that North Korea lost its partners in Eastern Europe and elsewhere in the world, say like in Africa or Southeast Asian countries. So the radius of action, so to speak, for the North Korean spy agencies shrank all the way down to the neighboring countries, and North Korea, so basically that's China. So, and then what happened after that was North Korea stopped kidnapping people for propaganda purposes. Instead, they started to kidnap South Koreans who North Koreans deemed to be a security threat because the South Koreans working in China would sometimes be suspected of helping North Koreans defect to South Korea.
This warning or announcement, if you will, comes just 3 or 4 days before the opening of the Workers' Party Congress in North Korea, an extraordinary event up there, the first in nearly 40 years. Was there anything to the timing of this?
It's just one event that's marking some milestone in North Korea, but then what's really going on in the background is the current standoff between South Korea and North Korea. I mean, the tension between the two countries has been going up ever since North Korea tested a nuclear bomb early this year. So the Party Congress is not directly connected with this announcement. This warning is more about a reflection of the current tension between the two countries.
Go Myung-hyun, however, doubts the North will conduct a fifth nuclear test anytime soon, saying it would likely cause a shortage of already limited fissile material without gaining much in the way of technological advancement. A 21-year-old Somali refugee is critically ill after setting herself on fire in Nauru, a tiny South Pacific republic where Australia runs an offshore detention camp. Some in Australia are using the incident to press their criticisms of the country's refugee policy, but the government in Canberra believes some refugee supporters are putting pressure on migrants to harm themselves for the attention that it will bring. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
A 21-year-old Somali refugee, Hodan Yassin, has been transferred to a hospital in the Australian city of Brisbane, where she's in a critical condition after setting herself on fire on the island of Nauru Monday. Refugee advocates say the injured woman was distressed after she was previously sent back to the South Pacific nation following medical treatment in Australia for injuries sustained in a road accident. Last week, a 23-year-old Iranian asylum seeker died after he set himself on fire at the Australian-run migrant centre on Nauru. It's one of two offshore processing camps sponsored by Australia as part of a policy to stop asylum seekers reaching its northern waters by boat. Even if detainees are found to be genuine refugees, they're not allowed to resettle in Australia. Australian Greens Senator Sarah Hanson-Young says her country is abandoning vulnerable people.
This is the ridiculous situation we are in, that these are people who have had their claims assessed, they've been found to be refugees, therefore they deserve to be looked after and given an opportunity to rebuild their lives. We shouldn't be having them languishing on Nauru even now, let alone for years and years to come. We should end this suffering and bring these people to Australia and allow them to get on with their lives.
Australian Immigration Minister Peter Dutton has accused refugee supporters of inflaming tensions on Nauru by encouraging migrants to take drastic measures to try to force Australia to change its border protection policies. Asylum seekers intercepted trying to reach Australia by sea are sent to either Manus Island in Papua New Guinea or to Nauru. Officials in Canberra say the policy is a deterrent and has stopped a steady flow of migrants trying to reach Australia by boat. Last week, the Papua New Guinea government said it would close the Australian facility on Manus Island after the country's Supreme Court ruled it illegal. A boat carrying Sri Lankan asylum seekers has reportedly arrived on the Cocos Islands, an Australian territory in the Indian Ocean. If confirmed, it would be the first refugee vessel to have reached Australian waters in almost 2 years. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Visit voanews.com for more on this story. You can follow us on Twitter as well at @VOA_IE and like us on Facebook at VOA Now. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. The annual Tony Awards are not handed out until just over a month from now, but one show is already a big winner, as VOA's Lori London and Ramon Taylor discuss.
They recognize achievement in live Broadway theater, and today we learned which shows have been nominated for the Tony Awards. And one show in particular, the musical Hamilton, grabbing the most nominations in Broadway history. Quite a feat. Let's talk more about it with VOA's Ramon Taylor in New York. Hi, Ramon.
Hi, Lori.
This is really incredible. Hamilton nominated in virtually every category and breaking a record.
That's right, 16 nominations, breaking every previous record just in that category. 15 was the previous record set by Billy Elliot and the producers, but this is really expected to fare even better during the actual awards ceremony on June 12th. I mean, just an electrifying performance, as you mentioned, nominated in every category: best play, musical, revival of a play, original score, lead actor, pitting two of the greatest actors in modern theater, modern Broadway history together in this year. It's going to be incredible.
What's the appeal? What's the show about?
Well, it's a historical theatrical piece, right? So when you think of U.S. history, when you think of Alexander Hamilton, one of the founding fathers and the right-hand man to George Washington, you might think dry history, but Manuel Lin-Miranda is a visionary, and he has merged hip-hop culture and history together in this just incredible performance that has the audience on its feet with a musical production that will undoubtedly win at the Tonys this year.
And what other shows got nominated?
Shuffle Along, that received 10 nominations. So by the standards of any other year, that is a great, you know, they have a great chance at this, at achieving something at least, let's put it that way. That's about a mayoral race in Jimtown, USA, touching on race relations and politics. Very exciting considering that this is an election year. Eclipsed, that is another great performance by Lupita Nyong'o, the Kenyan-Mexican actress who had a breakthrough performance in 12 Years a Slave. She's an incredible actress, and she'll be one to watch out for as well.
Twitter
ready.
And so
you're going to see history in the making this year with Hamilton. 16 nominations, June 12th.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much. We appreciate it. VOA's Ramon Taylor.
Thanks, Lori.
You've been listening to International Edition, and you can always find us anytime you like at voanews.com. Like us on Facebook, VOA Now, and follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Daryl Smith. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Thank you so much for joining us. We hope you have a wonderful day ahead.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In advance of World Press Freedom Day on May 3rd, the U.S. State Department highlighted emblematic cases of journalists around the world who have been targeted because of their profession. Journalists who have been imprisoned because they ran afoul of people in power who refused to allow the truth to be known about themselves or their societies or their governments. This year, the journalists featured in the State Department's Free the Press campaign come from places across the globe, including Cuba, Uzbekistan, China, Russia, and Iran. The Iranian journalist is Mohammad Sadiq Kaboudvand, who's been held in Evin prison since July 2007. He reported on torture in Iranian prisons, women's rights issues, and cases of human rights abuses against Iran's ethnic minorities. In July of 2007, Kaboudvand was arrested and charged with acting against national security and engaging in propaganda against the state. A revolutionary court ultimately sentenced him to 11 years in prison. At a briefing, State Department spokesperson John Kirby noted that Mr. Kaboudvand has reportedly suffered several heart attacks in custody, as well as serious kidney and intestinal problems, and that he has been refused appropriate medical treatment.
Kaboudvand has now served nearly 9 years of his sentence. Iran's penal code allows for early release after prisoners have served more than half of a sentence over 10 years. He has also reportedly been recommended for release by the warden of Evin prison.
The State Department calls on the Iranian government to release Mohammad Sadiq Kaboudvand and all other Iranian journalists and citizen journalists who are imprisoned simply for exercising the right to freedom of expression. The United States also urges the Iranian government to respect its citizens' rights to free expression and allow journalists to work in Iran without fear of violence and persecution.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage. www.voanews.com/editorials.